Good morning. I'd like to call the Senate Finance Committee to order. The time is 9:05 on March 2nd, 2020. Please turn off all cell phones. Today I'm joined by Co-Chair Von Imhoff, Senator Olson, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Hoffman. Senator Wilson is en route. Senator Stedman is away on other state business and is excused. And on today's agenda, we have one item, analyses of the ballot initiative 190GTX, oil and gas tax initiative. I'd like to say that if the meeting goes over this morning, we have reserved from 1:30 to 3, I believe, to come back and finish anything that we don't get covered this morning. And presenting today will be N3 Energy Consultants hired by the legislature, Rich and Christina Rosario. If you would please come forward and put yourselves on the record. And I see we have quite a few slides, and let's see if we can stay on schedule. And I think if it's all right, I'm looking at my committee members. Everybody looking this way, is it all right with you guys if we ask questions at the end of each slide? Would that be fine for you? All right, great. All right. Good morning. Welcome. Put yourself on the record. You know the drill, and let's start.
Good morning. My name is Rich Ruggiero, and I'm with N3 Energy.
Good morning. Christina Ruggiero, N3 Energy.
Good morning.
Good morning. Today, we're going to review the ballot initiative, as it said, 190GTX. We were given a request from the presiding officers to do an analysis of this initiative without taking into account any sponsors' intent, any other administrative body that may have looked at it and commented on it, or any outside influence. And the reason we really wanted to do that is to take a look that should this initiative pass, was there a clear route and a clear understanding through the initiative on how it would be implemented if passed, or might there be some areas where there might be some dispute with respect to what the wording is and how it might move forward. So at the high level, what we've done is we've taken a look at an initiative that clearly there are some assets that exist on the North Slope that it will provide a new set of taxation, a set of ring fencing, and different tax returns that will have to be done. What we found in going through it, that in each of these sections, there was enough leeway that there are multiple interpretations that are possible. And so what we wanted to go through today was to go section by section and to talk about, again, should this be enacted and voted in by the public? What are those alternatives? What different ways may this be looked at to sort of give the legislature an idea of what could be coming forward? I do note that after this was reviewed with Ledge Council, that there was a statement by the lawyers that it wasn't a matter of if this would likely go to some form of litigation. It would go to some form of litigation because of the degree of alternatives that are possible in reading this. What I'd like to do is just on slide number 4, it's a glossary slide. There's a number of terms that we're going to be using. I believe most of these you are familiar with, except the last one. Because it was not easy to discern in section 2 what exactly was being covered, throughout our written document and throughout the slides in our presentation today, we're just going to talk about anything that qualifies under the initiative is a 40/400 asset. And that prevents us from taking a position of whether it's a field, a unit, the non-utilized reservoir, et cetera. So we'll just refer generically as a 40/400 asset. So let's go through a high-level summary, and then we'll get into the various sections. As we talked about, we were asked to do a holistic view and to identify anything that appeared to where there might be alternative interpretations of the ballot initiative. If you've read our report, you'll note that we said it lacks specificity, making it very probable that there are multiple interpretations that could be reached depending on the position that one takes relative to this initiative. As we said, it looked like it was written to increase taxes on certain North Slope assets, but it did not in any way contain any provisions to incentivize any other operations on the slope. So it was really an initiative to increase or present new taxes on certain assets on the North Slope. And as we have as our last point, which is consistent with the comments that you heard at Ledge Council, there's enough ambiguity that with all the different interested parties that would be involved if this should pass, that would likely cause enough uncertainty that from my days of being working for oil companies, it would give me pause with respect to what I'm about to do, any investment decisions I might be able to make that could be deferred, would maybe likely be deferred as they would wait to see exactly how this initiative was going to be put into law and what regulations would be written so we would know how it was going to work.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Rich and Christina. Are you and Christina attorneys?
Representative Wilkowski through the chair, no. Okay.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Your job was to interpret this initiative. What is your understanding of what the Supreme Court has said is the most important thing to look at when interpreting an initiative?
Senator Wilkowski, as instructed, we do not look at anything outside other than the initiative itself.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Bill? Senator Wilkowski?
Did you communicate with anyone? You didn't communicate with anyone at all or read any other documents in preparing your report and making your conclusions?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, as noted in our report, it's quite clear. As noted in my opening statement, it was quite clear. We followed the instructions from the presiding officers and looked only at the two pages of the initiative. Based on our experience of having written legislation, written regulation, and advised governments in the past.
Thank you. Senator Olson?
Mr. Ruggiero, along the same line of questioning, have you ever been pulled in as a consultant for another ballot initiative in another state or another sovereignty?
Senator Olson, to the chair, no, we have not.
No further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have any idea at all what the court has said should be looked at in interpreting a ballot initiative?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, asked and answered. We did not look at anything outside of the initiative, which was our instruction.
Okay, so let me be clear. You followed the instructions of the presiding officers of both bodies, correct?
Yes, sir. That's exactly what we did.
Do we have a copy of that letter in each member's packet, I believe? Is that right? I'll have a copy of that letter just for your reference as we go through the slides. Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, and maybe I'm just missing it, but I'm looking at what was requested by the presiding officers, and the only limitation that I see is it says it is our expectation that the contractors, meaning the witnesses, as they conduct this analysis, will consider the initiative itself, but will not consider legislation that is based off any individual's interpretation of the initiative. Perhaps I'm missing it, but I don't see anywhere in here where it says you can't talk to the initiative sponsors or you can't review the articles or publicly available documents regarding the initiative. Am I missing that in the two-page instructions that I have here that are dated February 5th, 2020?
Senator Wilkowski, I don't have a copy of that in front of me to be able to comment, but what I can say is regardless of what the letter said, the way we conducted our analysis was not to look at any outside influence. We only looked at the two pages of the initiative in putting this analysis together.
Okay, so I think we've got your point, your argument, Senator Wilkowski. And I'd like to move on so we can get off this page. For now, Senator
Von Imhoff.
Von Imhoff.
Thank you. How many years have you been working on Alaska oil and gas policy? And how many years have you been working in oil and gas policy in general?
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, we've been working Alaska oil and gas issues since late 2006. And only for a brief period in between there, it's been continuous from 2006 until now. With respect to advising governments, we've advised over two dozen governments on their fiscal, petroleum fiscal policy, and have been doing that since the late 1990s.
Follow up?
So it's safe to say that you are extremely familiar with Alaskan tax law now for oil and gas, not only in Alaska, but nationally. So I feel very confident in your abilities to analyze this initiative.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess the point that I would make is that I have a 53-page document in front of me outlining all the potential ambiguities. The Supreme Court has said the thing that you look at in ballot initiatives are the published arguments and the intent of the sponsor. And this was not done. And so we're going to go through and spend 53 pages, the next two, maybe 4 hours of the day, picking through what the potential ambiguities are, when if the witness had simply spoken to the bill sponsor or looked at the published arguments, they would very clearly have been have figured out that there are really no ambiguities, or they could have ascertained what the intent was of the bill sponsor. That's what the Supreme Court says to look at. So you basically have a witness up here whose hands are tied behind his back. He hasn't looked at any of the documents. He hasn't looked at any of the arguments. He hasn't spoken with the bill sponsor. Hasn't looked at a bill which is filed, Senate Bill 29, which is substantially similar to this bill and fleshes out all of these issues. If this were a court, this witness would not be considered an expert witness. This document would be thrown out, and we wouldn't even be spending the next 4 hours listening to this. This is basically a meaningless exercise that will do nothing but confuse the people of the state of Alaska and create confusion and sow seeds of doubt and ambiguity when there really is none, or they could have been easily solved by simply speaking with the sponsor.
Thank you for your comments. So I think you've made your point. Now let's go through the presentation, and we'll let the presentation speak for itself.
On slide 7, just continuing our summary, what we've talked about is producers actually pay four different types of taxes. Essentially, it's royalty, property tax, production tax, and then the corporate income tax. And those collectively become the state share of oil and gas operations. As we read it, the initiative only makes changes to the production tax. It appears to create an increased gross minimum tax. It creates a new net tax on PTV, and it maintains, much like you have in the current structure, a greater of between the net tax and the gross tax. And what it appears, the one section that was fairly clear was that the initiative for the 40/400 assets removes the per barrel credits that you have in 024 INJ.
Before you move on, Senator Von Imhoff has a question, then I have a question on the 4,400 assets, because I think that needs to be explained a little bit more. So,
I just want to state for the record that the presentation being done today is by a qualified analyzer, if you will. And that it would be difficult for Alaskans to go outside the two-page ballot initiative. That's what a typical Alaskan would do. A typical Alaskan would not be calling the bill sponsor, if you will, or initiative sponsor. They would be taking a look at the initiative, just like we've asked in our engagement letter with this with 3 Energy. And I think that That is sufficient. If the bill sponsor wanted to be more clear, he would have been more clear in the two pages, and he is not. And so I think that I don't want to make this a political grandstanding around this table. I think it is important to allow these pages to go through. We've allotted a full day, and I just, there is some ambiguity. I've read the initiative, and it is difficult to interpret. So I feel that what we're asking our presenter today to do was a very reasonable task, and so I'm pleased to go forward with it.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess one of the questions I have is that, and it's more to the co-sponsor, are we planning on hearing from the initiative sponsor to see what their input is on this obviously very important initiative?
Thank you for the question, and I can't answer that at this point, so I'll have to hold your question. And
does the co-sponsor know, or does the co-chairman know?
I'm sorry, I did not listen.
Senator, restate your question again. I could paraphrase it, but I'll let you put it back on the record.
Because this is a very attention-getting subject, and the initiative is obviously has a sponsor on it. Are we going to hear from the initiative sponsor before this committee?
It is yet to be determined at this time. I think we're going to let things develop. It's quite possible that could occur, yes. It's definitely not out of the realm of possibility at this time, but I do want to just allow this to at least go through.
That's all the question I had, whether he was scheduled or not. If he's not scheduled, we'll go ahead and listen to the presentation.
Thank you. So could you explain the 4,400 a little bit deeper? Because there's, you know, people at home, they're probably wondering what 4,400 means.
Senator, we actually get to that in the discussion on Section 2, but I'll give a little preview again. I will admit that it's very clear that the sponsors intended that three large fields be captured under this initiative. Unfortunately, they didn't use the term just fields. They used fields, units, and non-unitized reservoirs, thereby clouding the definition of what it is they're exactly looking at. And as you'll see when we go through the Section 2 analysis, only one of those is defined in the current regs, which is unit. The other two are not defined. Even field is not defined in the tax regulations. And so, therefore, for us not to choose whether we're talking about fields or units or non-unitized reservoir and having to use that phrase every time that we refer to it, we coined the term a 40/400 asset because Section 2 has a requirement of 40,000 barrels a day and 400 million cumulative barrels of oil produced. So that's where the 40/400 asset came from.
Thank you. Please continue. Senator Walikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And once again, Mr. Chairman, this is sort of a futile, confusing exercise because Mr. Ruggiero just said, quote, it is very clear that it is the intent of the sponsor that the three large fields be captured. That's what the Supreme Court looks at, is the intent. And there's no need to spend 53 pages discussing ambiguities when he just said what the intent of the bill was. This is just going to create more confusion. We're going through it, but I just want that very clear on the record. This could all have been easily resolved by simply asking the sponsor. Thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you. The first, on slide number 9, we're going to go through Section 1. And we've just clipped, what you'll see as we go through the slides, we clip out the exact words that are in the initiative, and we have the whole Section 1 up there. We start off with something that's titled the Fair Share Act, and we know here in Alaska in the some 13 years that we've been coming up and testifying a number of issues, that the definition of what a fair share is not defined anywhere in existing statute, and it's not defined in this bill as well. So we just point out that what is the fair share is actually up for discussion, and depends on a person's interpretation. We also put in here that the term notwithstanding in the last sentence of the first section, that it appears that the use of that is the intent to override existing production tax language in 4355 for the assets that qualify under Section 2. And the only direct reference that we find in the initiative to anything in 4355 happens to be the changes in paragraph A in Section 4 on the per barrel credits.
Chair.
Senator Willikowski.
Yeah, thank you. Just on the short title, as we all know, Senate Bill 21, the short title is More Alaska Production Act, and it's actually led to less production. But what is your understanding of the legal significance of the short title?
Senator Willikowski to the chair. I don't think it has legal any legal standing. I'm just pointing out that as the public tries to look at it and determine what the fair share is, I think they might come to the conclusion that what you've got in this bill is the fair share.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up?
You're right. It has no legal, meaning, or very little. And you say, notwithstanding, in your second bullet, it appears the language of the initiative is to override existing production tax calculations. And it says, right, if you look at right under short title in the bold there, it says, notwithstanding any other statutory provisions, the oil and gas production tax in AS 40 through 55 shall be amended. It says right there, that is the purpose, to amend. Is that correct?
Senator Willikowski, through the chair, in fact it does, but as we go through later on, you'll see that there's inconsistency in how that interpretation of the notwithstanding is used as we get into Section 3 and 4.
Okay, so seeing no further questions, let's get to Section 3 and 4. Section 2 is a big section, so.
Continuing on to slide number 11 for Section 2. And we're gonna talk about that. It talks about that this section is supposed to state that the tax provisions in 3 and 4 only apply to oil that's produced from fields, units, and non-unitized reservoirs, basically on the North Slope, that have produced in excess of 40,000 barrels a day and 400 million cumulative barrels of oil. So this section is to determine which assets on the North Slope do qualify under here. And as we've talked about, we have on here, we've lumped this definition into a short form of 40/400 assets. And as we state down here, as we just did a minute ago, while we believe the reasoning was to isolate three fields, then the above language is not straightforward, and the above language raises several questions as we move forward.
So I have one question on the, it applies to the fields, units, and non-unitized reservoirs. So I had a question I was trying to comprehend. That would be prospective, non-unitized reservoirs, looking forward, the way the initiative is written.
Senator Bishop, we actually go through in a few slides and we talk about what a non-unitized reservoir actually is. And your question, if we can wait till then, will be answered in that description.
That's fine. Senator Barnum. Question? Nope. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, if I may just make a brief comment here. So when we have put together this slide presentation and we go section by section, we're reviewing what it is that section says, and then we're also bringing up our interpretation and different points that we might see. It's our understanding that should the initiative pass, that there's then a process that the legislature could go through amendments, or also that regulations would need to be written. So when we talk through these issues of these potential ambiguities or this wide latitude of interpretation, what we're really trying to do is help the legislature to see, should this pass and in the process afterwards, really how wide could this look? And so this section two is something that's very important because these are terms that are not only defined in the industry kind of as general terms, but then also you find them in different jurisdictions very narrowly defined. And so section two is an area where it's possible that should the state be in a position where the ballot initiative is to be implemented, there could be a wide range of fields or areas in the state that could end up applied, this, that would have the taxes in the ballot initiative applied.
Thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is it your understanding that to the extent ambiguities exist, that the sponsors of the initiative would have time between now and the election to cure those potential ambiguities?
Representative Wilkowski, through the chair, I don't, other than the process that the bill has been placed, the signatures have been obtained, and it will go on the ballot as it is. What the sponsor does between now and then, I'm not aware that he has any restrictions on what he does. I also don't know of any of his actions he takes between now and then that it would have any legal basis.
Senator Wilkins.
And just to clarify, this is crystal clear case law that the sponsors could go and write an op-ed. They could make a public statement. They could come before this legislature and testify. They could put it on their website what these ambiguities mean to clear up any ambiguities. And according to the Supreme Court, that clears it up. You understand that?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, as I'm not aware of the Supreme Court precedent that you're talking about, I can't opine. But what I would say is your continued reference to the Supreme Court is an obvious reference that you expect this to go to litigation with the Supreme Court to be the arbiter.
Mr. Chairman, no, actually that's not true because the language is crystal clear. And the Supreme Court is crystal clear that if there's ambiguities, the sponsor can clear that up by simply writing an op-ed, simply publishing an article. That's what the Supreme Court has said. And so if the sponsor writes an op-ed and says, this is what I mean, he's just cleared up your whole 53 pages of ambiguities. And he's erased all the confusion. That's what the Supreme Court has said.
Well, we're not a court of law here, so I appreciate people's opinion. There's two, you know, and
it's
we have
opinion.
Conflicting opinions. So could you continue on with the next?
Thank you, Chairman. We're on slide number 12. I think without going through all this, again, we talked about, for some unknown reason, the sponsor chose to use fields, units, and non-unitized reservoirs, which does not appear anywhere in statute or regulation that governs the taxation of oil and gas here in Alaska. 4355, which governs taxations, talks about leases and properties, and actually the only thing that is defined in 4355 is unit. Field and non-unitized reservoirs are not. Also, in looking at it, we just point out that it really wasn't clear from the way in which it was used whether that was a term to be used collectively, meaning something that qualified under any of those names, or whether that was meant to be three different types of assets that would have to go through the test of the 40,000 and the 400 million.
Please continue.
Slide 13, as we talked about, the term field is very common in the industry, but it does not appear in the oil and gas taxation statute. It does appear elsewhere within statute, section on AOGCC it appears, and we've been told now that buried in one of the regulations, there's a definition of field which is not much different than here. But you can see it says it has at least one or can include one or more pools of oil and gas in order to be a field. Now, when we talk about, as people talk about Prudhoe Bay, Kuparuk, Alpine, we have seen those in doing our research on the various sites, those sites being OGCC, DOR, DNR, revenue source books, et cetera, where there is not a consistent use in the state of what is a field. And things are basically described in multiple fashion. And so we're just pointing out that if the intent was to capture a field, there is no definition of field in the statute to guide, and that would be something that would have to be discerned with time as you went on.
Next.
Slide 14. As we said, there's no guidance on how you group wells into creating a field, but now in 4355-900, the unit is defined. And a unit in Alaska is basically a cooperative. A unit is where multiple operators get together and for the benefit of optimization of both spending, the building of facilities, and the operations of the field, get together and sign a unit operating agreement, name an operator, and then through that co-op operate those fields and bring that oil into production. And as we're aware, the North Slope contains quite a few number of units, and each one of those units is defined as containing a number of pools or fields of hydrocarbon. On slide 15, if we take the assumption that fields, units, and non-unitized reservoirs are three separate tests that could be done, that there are two ways in which North Slope production could qualify under Section 2. And the first is that everything that is within a unit could collectively meet the 40,000 barrel a day requirement and could collectively meet the 400 million barrels of cumulative production. The second is a single field within a unit by itself meets those two qualifications, and then because of that field meeting, then by default the entire unit of which it's a part of would also qualify as a 40/400 asset. So when we have fields qualifying like Alpine, Kaparik, and Prudhoe Bay, but because they are contained within units, then if we're looking at units being separate from fields, then the Colville River unit, the Kaparik River unit, and the Prudhoe Bay unit would also be 40/400 assets. So we could have three fields, and we could have three units that qualify. So that's a total of six entities under Section 2 that qualify as 40/400 assets. Slide 16 is just a map from AOGCC's website that shows the various units up on the North Slope, and the red dashed circles are showing the three units we just talked about, which are Prudhoe Bay, Kaparik, and Colville River. Now, next slide I'm not going to talk about in great detail, but the next three slides is we just pulled out the various units to show the number of pools of oil that are included in each of those units. So if, for example, if the definition of the Alpine field was the Alpine oil pool, by fact that those other five oil pools are in the Colville River unit, then they too would be collected and be determined under Section 2 as being 40/400 assets. And you can see, I'm not going to go into detail, but on Kaparik River, you have the same thing where there's nine other pools of oil that can be included, and when we go to slide 19, we have the Prudhoe oil pool, but we have 17 other pools of oil that could find itself part of the Prudhoe Bay unit and therefore captured as 40/400 assets.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. And I can just say I spoke with the bill sponsor, Mr. Brenna, who's an oil and gas attorney, and he informed me that the intent was on slide 17 that every pool within the Colville River unit is intended to be ring-fenced together. On slide 18, every pool within the Kaparik River unit is intended to be ring-fenced together, and every pool within the Prudhoe Bay unit is intended to be ring-fenced together. So I've just solved the ambiguity problems that exist in the last 10 slides you've done.
Please continue then on to slide 20. Mr. Chairman, this goes to the question you asked you earlier about a non-unitized reservoir. It doesn't appear anywhere in Alaska statute or regulation. Actually, in the industry, a unitized reservoir is a common reservoir that crosses ownership boundaries, lease ownership, field ownership, etc. And a unitized reservoir will have a unitization agreement, and that agreement then gets together all the ownership interest under which that reservoir underlies, and they'll determine what share of the reserves are owned by each of the different ownership groups. They'll come up and name one of them as the operator, and all ownership groups will jointly put together a development plan, and then they will then fund that development plan and share in the revenues by their updated working interest based on the unitized reservoir. Now, the definition of units in Alaska don't represent the unitization of a reservoir. As stated before and in the definition in 4355-900, a unit is basically a co-op of multiple reservoirs of oil or gas that come together to form a unit. So one interpretation that is possible, that if it's intended that non-unitized reservoirs be part of Section 2, then any and all wells that produce from the same reservoir on the North Slope could be deemed a non-unitized reservoir. Oops, wrong way. Slide 21. And I think just to finish from slide 20, as has been pointed out, the West Sac Reservoir exists across the slope. So if you're actually to take a definition of non-unitized reservoir, which is, and that appears there in Section 2, non-unitized reservoir, you could have all of the West Sac be qualified as a 40/400 asset on the slope. Now on to slide 21. It, up there in the box in orange that we have blocked off, it says, the assets have to have produced in excess of 40,000 barrels of oil per day in the previous year. It's just, this is just one of those. It doesn't say whether it has to do it once or it has to do it on average for the year. And a couple of, the use of such words as average or on any day could have easily cleared that up. We also look at if it's qualified as a 40/400 asset, when do the new taxes under Section 3 and 4 begin to apply? And then for how long do they last? So do they apply beginning January of the following year? Do they apply for the whole year even if production falls below 40? And we're just saying there's no clarity on that in the initiative. On slide 22, as we've just talked about, units as well as fields may come into the fact that today they don't qualify as a 40/400 asset, but they might in the future. And usually when a unit or a field will qualify, it's always been producing in excess of 40,000 barrels a day, because that's the only way it's going to get to the cumulative oil. So once the cumulative production exceeds 400 million barrels, again, the initiative is silent on whether it immediately becomes subject to the rest of the initiative, and especially the taxes under Section 3 and 4, or whether it starts at the next beginning of the next calendar year. And there's no end there. The other thing is it something which we'll talk later when we get into the two sections on tax, is usually the taxation in Alaska is only based on taxable barrels, not on produced barrels. And so one thing that is not specified here in Section 2 is whether or not the production that's being talked about is total production or taxable barrel production. And also, we also have other losses in the system, so we put up there, where's this production to be measured? Is it measured on total sales in the market? Is it the barrels into taps? Is it wellhead barrels? Or as we said, is it taxable or total? Now, if it's taxable or total, roughly those two differ by royalty. And for the older fields, that's a 1/8 royalty, so that's a plus or minus 12% difference. That is a considerable difference in considering whether something qualifies or not. So at the 40, just take the 40,000 barrels a day. If that's the total barrels at 40, that if it meant to be taxable, the taxable would be under 36,000 barrels a day. So it's very critical on whether it's total barrels or taxable barrels. And there's actually nothing here in Section 2 to guide you as to which one of those they mean. Slide 23, as we said, the intent was on the, it's kind of in summary for Section 2. We've heard the intent is to raise taxes on the three large legacy fields. But again, depending on how the definition of field units and ununitized reservoirs ends up being defined, there are multiple interpretations, which could have much more of the North Slope qualifying as 4,400 assets. And again, we said other than being immediately applicable to the three new large fields, it's unclear what other assets should qualify when the new taxes under this would begin to apply. So if no questions, I'll move on to Section 3. We'll go to slide 25. What it appears is that this is a monthly gross tax meant to replace the current gross minimum tax that currently ranges from 0 to 4% of the gross value at the point of production, with a new tax that ranges from 10% to 15% of the gross value at the point of production. We do not find that there's anything in here that alters the definition of the gross value at the point of production on how it's currently defined. And also in here, they refer to, in paragraph A, the price on the West Coast with the parenthetical Allay Basin. And that appears to have been added intentionally, as the inclusion of the parenthetical Allay Basin does not appear anywhere in 4355 when they refer to the ANS West Coast price. So this is clearly a change that doesn't provide any insight as to why it was made or what it is intended to accomplish.
Then I'm assuming LA Basin is Los Angeles?
That was our assumption, Mr. Chair, that it was Los Angeles.
Thank you. And not Louisiana. Okay.
Can I just ask?
Senator Von Imhoff.
So are there different prices then of West Coast in different regions?
Senator Von Imhoff, the chair, my understanding is this crude does get sold in various places along the West Coast, and I'm not aware of the sales arrangements, so I can't opine on if there is much of a difference and how much that difference might be as to why you pick one specific point instead of another, or why they would have chosen to use a different definition than the rest of the statute uses.
Thank you. Follow up?
Are any of those prices public? I mean, could I go on an app on my phone and see all the different prices being negotiated up and down the West Coast?
Senator Ron, through the chair, there is one that is published, but I'm actually not aware of exactly the specific location on which that published price is based.
Okay, thank you. Please continue.
Continuing on to slide 26, paragraph B of section 3 just talks about putting a degree of progressivity into the gross tax. And again, it's not clear that it's a step function, and we just said it's open that it could be a continuous function of an increase at the rate of 1% for every $5 change, or it could be a step function. And we just said this just leaves it open. Now, the current tax is on a step function, where once you cross a certain price, it goes up 1% for the full next $5. This wasn't made clear. And then the last sentence just says, you know, the end of that section just says when the price per barrel is equal to or exceeds 70. Now, the rest of that section 3 was very clear to use ANS West Coast slash, you know, open paren, LA Basin, close paren every time they talked about price. You know, you can say one could assume that that's where the 70 is as well, but they just didn't put that in there when they defined where that $70 would be. On slide 27, we just wanted to show that if you assume that what was intended was that it was a step function and they were referring to $70 as ANS West Coast, then you can see the table on how the West Coast prices are used to determine the gross tax amount on the current 4355 structure and then on the initiative to the right.
Sir Wilkowski.
Thank you. On the chart that you created for the initiative, it says that greater than zero or equal to 50 is a 10% gross tax, but up above in the actual wording, it says an additional 1% of the gross value. Basically, you add a 1% when it's equal to or exceeds $50. So it looks like it should be under ANS West Coast dollar per barrel, it should be an equal to zero and a greater than sign or less than. You see what I'm saying?
Well, Councilor Chair, you're correct.
Thank you.
Okay. No further questions. Please continue.
On to slide 28. Subparagraph C of section 3 made us scratch our head quite a bit as to why it was there and also what it meant. Is under current statute, there are no deductions allowed from GVPP before calculating the gross minimum tax. However, here they've included in the alternative gross minimum tax section this subsection C that talks about no deductions, no carry forward expenditures, no operating losses, offsets, etc. And again, we don't see why that was included in this section. It appears more appropriate for section 4, which is the net tax, because those are the types of deductions that are allowed from GVPP to determine the production tax value upon which the net tax is due. So again, if the intent of the parties were to make this gross tax a hard floor, meaning no deductions, no anything would allow it to become anything less, then that could have been easily made clear that this was a hard floor. And again, but we're unable to discern what it means to have this section C in, the subparagraph C in section 3. No questions, I'll move on to section 4. Section 4 starts with subparagraph A, which appears to us to clearly state that the credits that are now allowed in 024 I and J are not to be used. And these happen to be the $5 per barrel credit for GVR eligible fields and the $0 to $8 per barrel credit for all other fields. So we're just saying here, for some reason, the author of the initiative chose to put a clear reference, which then gives you a clear interpretation of what was intended. Move on to 31. One thing we want to note and start with is that under AS 4355, both gross taxes and net taxes are production taxes. Let's make that clear. They're both referred to in the statute as production taxes. So when I come to paragraph B and it says an additional production tax, there are two possible interpretations. One is that it is a production tax in addition to Section 3, which is in and of itself a production tax, or that it was possibly meant to be an additional tax on top of other taxes existing in 4355. And what we're saying is nowhere in the initiative itself is there any direct or implied reference to any current applicable net tax on PTV in AS 4355. Move on to slide number 32. Again, we're being purist in our review of this, but then again, that's what we're asked to do, is to help point out anything that's a bit different. But in subparagraph B, they use two different definitions of production tax value. One is of taxable oil, and then in the following sentence, it's of a barrel of oil, and then it gets into, so one is of oil means all the oil. That's a cumulative type phrase, and it is used in 4355 to talk about the production tax value as the overall dollar value of all the barrels at that point. Whereas the PTV of a barrel is talking about the unit value of the production tax value, and that is the production tax value divided by the taxable barrels.
Senator Wilkowski.
What do you think is a reasonable interpretation of that section?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, what particular aspect of that section?
How you tax it, how you compute the tax. It's clear. It's $50 per barrel profit, per a barrel of oil. Isn't that clear?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, as you can tell from our memo and from the notes that we have up here, it is not crystal clear on how to interpret that. There are multiple interpretations that are available, because whether it's of all the barrels or per barrel, as you'll also, I'm kind of jumping ahead to slide 33, there's also this confusion that in two sentences back to back, there's the use of taxable and then just the use of barrel. And as we talked about previously under section 2, there's a 12% difference between those two. So if you're asking me how do I interpret it, I say I'm confused.
Senator Wilkowski.
What do you think would be a reasonable interpretation of this? You're incapable of giving a reasonable interpretation of this, or can you?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I'm not going to give an interpretation. What I'm giving to you is we're trying to highlight the alternative ways in which it could be interpreted. There are multiple interpretations possible of this section 4, multiple. And this is the type of multiple interpretations that eventually will have to be dealt with if this is voted into law.
Please continue.
Okay. The last point I just want to make is the last bullet point on the slide. By what it's got up here is the additional tax will apply every month. Slide 33 just goes over what I just said a minute ago. We have taxable oil, and then we have oil. And again, 4355 is consistent that throughout it only talks about taxable oil. You don't find it talking about oil in general. And so again, this issue of are we talking about all production, or are we talking just about taxable production? And in two consecutive sentences, they choose to use the word taxable in one and taxable not in the other. That's up to the reader to interpret whether that was meant to be something intentional or that was just a mistake that was made by the drafter and the sponsor.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Ruggiero, you talked about the two terms different by roughly 12%. Can you give me just a brief explanation of where this 12% comes from?
Senator Olson, through the chair, the 12% comes from the royalty. So, for example, if I have 1,000 barrels of total oil and I have a 1/8 royalty, which most of these old leases do, then I would take that 1/8 and subtract it, which would be 125 barrels, and I would only end up with 875 barrels of taxable oil. So I either have 1,000 barrels of total oil or 875 barrels of taxable oil. And when trying to put together the figure out what tax I pay on what basis, whether I'm talking about total production or taxable production is quite a significant difference.
no further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Please continue.
We'll move on to Section 5. Section 5 is, again, where we began to scratch our head a little bit, is that Section 2 noted that the taxes under 3 and 4 can only apply to oil. But now we come here to Section 5, and in subparagraph A, it now states that the taxes apply to gas as well. So as you read that, it says, for each producer, the taxes in Section 3 and 4 shall be calculated for both oil and for gas. And so we're quite confused there. And we think that the inclusion of gas just opens the door to not just one or two interpretations, but many interpretations on what was meant by that. Was gas to be included separately on each 40/400 asset? Was the gas just to be separated from the oil, but it was still going to be included with other North Slope assets in calculating that tax return? We just said it's just not clear how gas, why gas appears here when Section 2 said this was only for oil, and then if you do include gas here, how the gas was supposed to be treated.
I have a question too, but I'll go to Senator Wilikowski first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How much gas is being produced and taxed from the 4,400 assets right now?
Senator Wilikowski, I know that a lot of gas is being used for fuel purposes from those fields. I don't know how much of it is sold to other operators. If it is, that revenue would be taxed under the 4355 as additional revenue. How much that is, I'm not aware of.
Follow up.
Could you find out and how much gas is being taxed in the 4,400 assets and get back to us, please?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, that would be something that the DOR would have to give to you because we don't have access to those tax records.
Senator Wilkowski, I'll make sure that Department of Revenue gives us that information because we do know they're cycling 8.5 B a day for EOR. Enhanced oil recovery. So I'll be quiet because I got a question on this. Senator Bonima.
I just follow up? Yeah. And I know they're cycling a huge amount of gas, and that cycling gas is not being taxed. I can tell you that for certainty. If there's any gas that's being sold among producers, it's a small amount. It's certainly not any of any significant amount to the to production taxes that the state receives. Thank you. That's all.
Thank you. Please continue.
Through the chair, if I may, Senator Wilikowski, one of the things that we're also concerned about is under the current legislation, all the gas costs, including all those for the recycling, are included as oil lease expenses and deducted against the GVPP for oil for calculating the oil tax. What's unclear from here, because it says shall be done separately, was one of the intentions of this to cause a separation of the oil expenses from the gas expenses. And I know that this body spent 2 years talking about the separate taxation of oil and gas and the separation of those expenses. And one of the conclusions of that it was going to be a huge administrative nightmare to be able to separate those expenses out. But that is an interpretation that one can take when you start saying here that things shall be calculated separately. To me, one very plausible interpretation is I calculate gas expenses separately.
Thank you. Please continue.
Okay. We'll continue. Let's go on to slide number 36. After reading Section 5, where it said for oil and gas, we had to come back and we just lumped the opening sentence of each of the sort of the five or the four sections there, 2 through 5. And we note the changing terminology, and we're not sure what to take from that. But Section 2 is very adamant, it's only oil. Then you go to Section 3 and it says oil production. Not only oil production, just says oil production. May not be anything to glean from that, there may be something. When we get to Section 4, it says production. Now we know production is both oil and gas. They get produced together, not produced separately. And now when we get to Section 5, it's very explicit that it applies for oil and for gas. So we start off in Section 2 as only oil, and we end up in Section 5 as for oil and for gas. And we just say this opens this up to significant interpretation and different alternatives as what's intended by each of these sections and by the initiative collectively as a whole.
Senator Von Amel.
So I think that you've highlighted it well, that it's, to me, it's less of an issue of how much the state of Alaska is taxing gas at this time, but more of one, two, three, four sections all say different things. So that seems to be more of the takeaway.
Senator Brown, up through the chair, I try to put myself, I mean, I've been involved with writing legislation and regulation for many different governments. And I put myself in the chair of the person that's going to sit here and try and write this initiative passes, and now I've got to write a regulation. Given this type of language, how do I write the regulation? Is it only oil? Is it oil and gas? Does it mean I separate gas expenditures from oil? I mean, there's great latitude and a large number of different variations in how those regulations could be written. You know, the hope would have been that the initiative itself would have been specific to what it wanted, and it would make writing those regulations real easy. But I think, as Christina pointed out earlier, we saw our job as pointing out all the areas where there was this ambiguity, where there are positive different alternatives, and for as much of that to be cleared up as possible or to be thought about ahead of time in event that this initiative does pass.
And I believe if the initiative passes, the interpretation will come from the reviser of statutes and the departments that's affected by this.
Yes. Let me move on then to slide number 37. Paragraph B basically says for each calendar month, expenditures are going to be divided. Annual expenditures are going to be divided on a 1/12 basis. What it appears when you read Section 6 with Section 5 is there's going to be monthly taxes that are filed. Currently, under 4355, there are estimated taxes paid or done each month with an installment payment, and then those installments are trued up in one annual tax return. So at the end of the year, there's only one tax return per operator on the North Slope. What this appears to do is to create a monthly tax return. As we look at the Culver River, Kuparik, and Prudhoe Bay units, I looked at from the DOR on the lease ownership that there were nine different distinct owners, and because of the ring fences on each of these units. So what you have then is you're going to have 96 tax returns done. Those are the monthly tax returns by each owner, by each asset. And then at the end of the year, when you actually know what your actual expenses are, you're going to have to go back and refile those 96 as amended because you didn't know what your actual 1/12th of your annual expense was going to be until the end of the year when you know what those annual expenses are finally are. So just as a start, it appears that this is calling for, at a minimum, close to 200 tax returns to be done for every calendar year for all the 40/400 assets.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you helped to, you were involved in the development of ACEs, and under ACEs, the way lease expenditures were counted for the monthly progressivity calculation was that the annual numbers were divided by 12. Is that correct?
Senator Wilkowski, to the chair, that's my understanding, yes.
So it was a monthly calculation for ACEs?
Senator Wilkowski, that was ACEs. We're talking about the initiative.
Thank you.
Just a comment from me on this section right here. I could, unless I'm all wet, I could see where this could get pretty labor intensive at the end of the year for the Department of Revenue when it comes to refunds.
Mr. Chair,
there's
yes.
A lot of variables here.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to point out on this topic of the monthly tax returns, when you have an annual return but you're doing monthly estimates and monthly installments, in a structure where you have a greater of between the min tax and the net tax, that means at the end of those 12 months, when you do your yearly return, all 12 months are subject on that return to the min tax or to the net tax. If you go to a system where you have monthly taxes due, so monthly returns, within that year, within those 12 months, you could be switching between that structure of the greater of. And so we would just consider that also in the audit process.
Senator Wilkowski.
How would you say our current tax structure is SB 21 in terms of complexity? Would you say on the scale of the worldwide complexity, where how do we currently rate?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, SB 21 only changed certain aspects of your taxation system. So if I comment only on what was unique in SB 21, it's also a very unique taxing structure because it's the only one I'm aware of that has negative progressivity. If I look at the totality of SB 21 with the rest of your statutes, it's quite a complex system.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I continue, yeah, Christina brought up a point which gets to our third bullet, which is how you apply tax credits, carry forward credits, losses, et cetera. There are quite extensive regulations on how you can use expenses. When you're calculating the greater of net and gross, I'm going to oversimplify, you know, subject to DOR coming up here and correcting me. But if I have a lot of expenses that would have taken the net tax below the gross tax, I only claim those losses that take me down on the net tax to equal the gross. Any excess becomes a carry forward. So this initiative is entirely silent, and as Christina said, you could be gross one month, net the next. You know, we get a one-month blip in the oil price, or production goes down a bit because you're doing repairs. So there's a lot of ways in which you can go from net to gross. So this not only involves the monthly tax returns, but now you're going to have to totally rewrite some very complex, some very detailed regulations on how I use my expenses, how I use my credits, how I use any losses, and then how I carry them not year to year, but month to month. And again, that would the end of the year thing, when I go in and do my taxes and I'm have to amend them based on the actual amounts, I'm also going to be amending how I do all those calculations on my losses, if there are losses, and use of those going forward. So there's quite a bit of work for whoever's writing the regulations to go with this. There's quite a bit for them to interpret that is not talked about in the initiative. And this use of credits, et cetera, was only in the section on GVPP, which they have nothing to do with GVPP today. So that's why our curious comment about section 3, subparagraph C. If we go on here now to slide 38, as we said, this is where we talk about the things being done monthly. We may have existing tax credits, operating losses, et cetera, on how those are going to be used. And the other thing that will have to happen is, to the extent that there are any common facilities, the last bullet point, that a 40/400 asset is using with non-4400/ assets, those common facilities are now going to have to go through an exercise of breaking the cost up for those common facilities into each of the individual pools and assets that are using them. We just, again, another layer of administrative complexity for DOR and for the producers. Let's move on now to section 6. I'm just going to read it because it's very short. For each producer, so that's individual by producer, for each month, so we're going to do the monthly taxes, for each, I'm going to call it 40/400 asset, the tax due shall be the greater of the tax under section 3 or 4. So the above states very explicitly that the tax due is based on the taxes that appear under Section 3 or Section 4. Neither this Section 6 nor in Section 3 or 4 are there any references, indirect or implied, to the inclusion of any other taxes under 4355 other than the exclusion of the per barrel credits under 024 INJ. Again, the language here only talks about the tax under Section 4 and not in addition of Section 4 in addition to anything such as AS 4355011E2, which is the 35% base tax on PTV that currently exists for assets on the North Slope. And then the last bullet point, whereas Section 5 defined what needed to be handled and treated separately on a monthly basis, it really never called for each asset to have its own tax return, but we believe that the use of the term for each of here in Section 6 means that we have to do these monthly returns by each asset, by each operator in each asset. So quite literally, we're putting ring fences around multiple assets on the North Slope separately for calculating the taxes due. Now, we did point out, and again, this could be cleared up fairly easily in regulation, but we just point out that if I'm taxing separately, as it says, for each of the fields and the units, I can have a field that qualifies on its own as a 4400, and I can have a unit that it's contained in as a 40/400 asset. If they each had to do separate tax returns, as is implied here, either you get into confusion as to what you claim on one versus the other, or there's a possibility of some form of double taxation implied here. On to slide 42 for Section 7. Section 7 calls for transparency. We've been on the record many times before many bodies in the two houses here that we think the state is deserving of more transparency. But we believe that one interpretation of Section 7 can go quite too far because it actually talks about all filings and all supporting information. So all supporting information that goes into a tax return goes all the way down to the various invoices that get received and paid for everything that goes on from who brings the bottled water to who delivers the drill pipe. And it's talking about this being a matter of public record. And I'll leave for others, but my understanding always that things were a matter of public record could either be confidential or non-confidential. And whether or not the way this is worded means it actually makes it public or not is one of the questions. But what this does say, though, is if everything, if all filings, not just the tax return itself and all supporting information, you get into the original filing and the amended filings. You get into all the documents that change hand when you're doing an audit, and you can get into all the documents that change hand when you're doing a negotiated settlement. So you could take this in one extreme that the word all means all, and this would expose quite a bit of data. In kind of raising or answering a question that was raised earlier, how does Alaska compare? This would take transparency way beyond what any other regime requires of the oil industry.
Sir Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You testified January 31st, 2018. Here's a quote. This is from you. What I can say is some of the most transparent regimes that I am aware of, people don't lose competition or competitiveness, and they don't lose their edge, and they don't lose people coming in to develop. In fact, it is just the opposite. The more transparent, usually the more activity they have and the more investment they have. Do you still agree with that statement?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I do agree because I was referring, I believe, at the time to something like what Norway provides. In Norway, I can go field by field. I get the production, I get the capital costs, I get when that capital cost is spent, I get the operating cost, I get the total dollars of royalty and the total dollars of tax spent. And there's a number of other pieces of information on a well-by-well basis that I can drill down into. What I don't have in any other regime is what could be interpreted from Section 7, which is that this drills down to the invoice level, that this drills down into papers used during negotiations, settlements, or audits. No other regime does that. So when I made that comment, which I still stand by 100% today, it was based on what other regimes make transparent and readily available to the public.
Thank you. Please continue. Oh, Senator Byam.
So today, aren't like construction bids and so forth generally closed bids? Like, no one knows what the other competitor is bidding at this point. Like, if you were to bid for a large job on the North Slope or something like that, correct?
Senator, I'll hop through the chair. That's my understanding. Yeah.
So if this were to go through, then all the way down to the invoice level, as in what contracts may be awarded, will be available for other folks to take a look at. And so when future bidding goes forward, they'll know how to underscore Alaskan businesses.
Senator Ron Hip, up to the chair. One of the things Christine and I discussed when we were doing this is we both worked for a service company for a period of time. I worked at an executive level. Christina worked on managing contracts. And I can tell you from my position, I would have been recommending to my most senior management that we take a serious look at Alaska. Should this pass and should everything become available, I would not want my rate sheet. I would not want my master service contract. I would not want any discounts I gave or whatnot. If all that became public, that could jeopardize my business around the globe, because that would all be exposed here. And so I would have to, as a company, we would have had to take a look to see if it was worth the risk of continuing to do business here and having all that exposed, or whether it would be in the corporation's best interest to pull out.
Senator Wolkowski.
Once again, Mr. Chairman, an extraordinary level of an extraordinary statement that can easily be cleared up by asking the bill sponsor what the intent was, and which I am sure was not to expose confidential information. And they could very easily write an op-ed, and it could very easily have been cleared up had the witness just simply asked the bill sponsor what they intended. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, through the chair, Senator Wolkowski, it could have just as easily have said total cost, total taxes, total royalty, and all this could have been avoided. But it did intentionally write all filings and all supporting information.
Please continue.
Slide 43, we really talked about all the things that could be made a matter of public record. And again, it's kind of interesting that when you talk about all filings and supporting information is communication back and forth with the DOR. It could catch some DOR records as well in the public disclosure. Again, this may be a small nit again, but we just wonder why, if throughout AS 4355, Department of Revenue is always referred to with a lowercase d, that by using the uppercase, what was intended by that? Now, in some other statutes where there's a common department that is always handling the business, like the DOR, they might use the capitalization department when they're referring to things like DNR or the Department of Labor, et cetera. So we're not sure what that meant. It may, again, just be one of those small bad drafting errors by the sponsor, or it may mean something else. We were able to discern from what's written what that means. Section 8. We just highlight exactly what it says, is that 8 places no restrictions on the extra revenue that is pulled in by this initiative on what it be used for, and just highlight that it explicitly allows, if it's so intended, to be used for permanent fund dividends. And then if we move on to slide 47, this is very typical in contracts and bills, et cetera, that this is the clause that says if one piece of it is ruled invalid, it doesn't mean the rest of it's invalid. It means the rest of it stays in place and is to be acted upon best as possible. So we'll move on to slide 49 as the letter from the presiding officers asks some specific questions. How would it change the current oil and gas fiscal regime? As we said, it creates new tax rig fences around each producer for each asset that meets the qualification as a 40/400 asset. It raises the gross minimum tax. It creates a new net tax on PTV when prices exceed a threshold. And details on that are contained previously. Now, when we reviewed this in the other body, there was a question raised and said, despite there being no specific reference to, let's call it the 35% base tax, net tax, that is what was intended. Well, if you look at the language and said the notwithstanding didn't prevent that from happening, well, if the notwithstanding doesn't prevent that, then you could also take the interpretation that under Section 3, that the gross minimum tax is in addition to the gross minimum tax that already exists. So instead of having a gross minimum that goes from 10 to 15, you have a gross minimum that essentially goes from 14 to 19. So the same logic that would say you pull in what's already existing there because it wasn't overwritten, Section 3 didn't overwrite the minimum tax that was there, so the same logic would say you have to apply that to Section 3. So how it impacts the existing tax, if you're going to apply a certain logic, it has to be applied throughout and not one section on one and not use it on the other section. Let's go to slide 50. Identify provisions which may generally affect investment on the North Slope, such as disclosure of previous confidential taxpayer information. As far as investment goes, there are no provisions in the initiative that encourage or incentivize more investment. In fact, by ring fencing, it actually handicaps the existing owners of production, taxable production on the slope. It handicaps them to be unable to recover, as they do under the current legislation, investments that they make outside a 40/400 asset. So it brings them down to, it does bring them down to the same level as new players on the slope. There's nothing in this initiative that enhances or encourages or incentivizes new investment. Because of the multiple possible interpretations, it does create a bit of confusion and uncertainty in the industry. It would be my expectation that that would cause, to the extent that the capital spending is discretionary, it would cause a pause in that spending until it becomes clear what the regulations are going to be, is it going to be litigated, and where things might end up as to what exactly is going to be the new regulation for taxing oil and gas from the 40/400 assets.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the extent that any ambiguities cannot be cleared up by the published arguments as the Supreme Court has said they are to be cleared up. The legislature, you're aware the legislature could pass legislation. They could call themselves into a special session or right at the beginning of the session next year pass legislation to clear up ambiguities. Is that correct?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, as Christina stated, that's our sole reason for pointing out all the ambiguities to give the legislator a roadmap as to what's possible. And so, therefore, they can then choose that which they wish to clear up and how they wish to clear it up.
Follow up.
And when ACES was passed, that bill was effective January 1, 2008. And the day that was passed, the Department of Tax issued an advisory bulletin on how to interpret portions of it. And then within 1 month, they issued draft regulations. Are you familiar with that?
Senator Wilkowski, I'll take it subject to check.
Okay. Another one, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, and then If that's your last one, then last I want to go to, if it's not, I'd like to go back to Senator Von Imhoff after you answer this.
One more, Mr. Chairman. And then under Senate Bill 21, which the industry proposed and supported, that bill was signed into law on June 24th, 2013, and then roughly 46 pages of proposed regulations came out on July 19th, 2013, so less than 1 month. Is that correct?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, subject to check, I'll take what you say, but my comment would be both the ACES bill and SB 21 were multiple pages in length, dozens of pages in length, and created a specific tax, a specific way in which that tax was to be handled. And so the writing of regulations, when you have something that's very specific, is not that difficult. When I take something that has ambiguity throughout, and where there are multiple interpretations, which neither ACES or SB 21 did, where you have the multiple interpretations that you do here, I doubt you're going to get a full set of regulations in 1 month.
Senator Von Allen.
Thank you. There are laws in the books that do limit legislative edits on any initiative. So it's not like we can rewrite the whole thing in the event that it does pass. We are limited. I just wanted to state that for the record. Secondly, this particular slide is worrisome. There are no provisions of the initiative that encourage or incentivize more investment. And we have a volume issue through TAPS. Our volume is waning here in Alaska. Wyoming, North Dakota, Texas, Louisiana, and California have all passed up Alaska in production in the last decade. And it is more expensive and more difficult to drill oil here in Alaska. And in order to keep us competitive, we passed SB 21, which is absolutely working. We have increased investment in Alaska to levels we have not seen in decades. We have investment in new wells, new fields, new life to the North Slope. Conoco calls it a renaissance. And we will begin to see the fruits of this effort soon, as early as 22 and 23, with additional of 100 to maybe 300 additional barrels per day, which will be significant revenue, significant jobs to the state of Alaska. If this initiative passed, do you think that this could potentially halt some of this activity in Alaska? And in terms of possible investment or forward progress, what do you think will happen?
Senator Ron, I hope to the chair, I don't sit with any of those companies, so I can't say whether it's going to halt or not. I just said, from my view of being in the industry and having been in a big oil company, as I said in the bottom, it would likely slow the capital spending. Whether that's a slight slowing or it's a halt, I can't tell you. But what we did go over and talk a little bit in the Energy Committee in the other House is an understanding that today, where Alaska was once a third of all U.S. reserves, it's now down to 5% as of the end of 2018, and likely to be below 3% at the end of 2019 when those numbers are released. It was at one time 22% of North America reserves. It's now down to 1%. So Alaska is not really on the tips of every board member saying, should we go to Alaska, because there are a lot of opportunities elsewhere for people to go with their money. And I think when BP testified at the BP Hill Corp meeting on Wednesday evening last week, the BP representative was very clear. We have billions of dollars of opportunity on the slope, and we also had the same $1 billion of opportunity in the lower 48. Their management happened to choose the lower 48 for a number of reasons that he stated. I think what you get to is this will cause a pause. This will cause people to rethink. And if you were at the training on Saturday, we gave some examples on how expensive it is to go from being able to immediately write off to have to hold those expenses for 7 to 10 years before I can recover them. The expected profit level goes way up on what they need to be able to see. So I would definitely think that if you ring fence these large fields, if the spending on the new fields is not able to be used as it is used today, that will cause a pause the degree of that pause, I can't tell you how big it's going to be.
Follow-up?
So the concern is that the with a 300% tax increase, which is what this initiative looks like it's doing, that it is so punitive that the behavior on the North Slope, we risk switching to a grab and go and take as much money as we can until costs just become so prohibitive that production pretty much ceases, and the roughly $2 billion that we see in revenue each year will probably wane in less than a decade. And that still remains about 40 to 45% of our total revenue. So it's pretty significant. This slide is a pretty good summary of what may come to be.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I do just want to point out that under SB 21, investment on the slope, on the North Slope, has not increased. It has actually declined. Investment at Prudhoe Bay, in fact, has declined from over $800 million per year to just over $200 million per year under SB 21. Jobs have declined from over 14,800 per year to about 9,600 per year, a loss of over 5,000 jobs. And not only have jobs declined, but the number of outside workers, non-resident workers, has increased during that time frame. Production's down. State revenue is down significantly. So basically, everything that we were told would happen under Senate Bill 21, more jobs, more production, more revenue, more investment, has not come true. I think that's important for the public to understand that, because those records are crystal clear. Everything is down.
So, all right, everybody got their comments on the record? I'd like to continue, but I just would like to say that a 4,500 person employment shift from a high of 14.5 down to about 9,500, a lot of that had to do with the price of a barrel of oil. So, anyway, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on to slide 51. I ask that we identify provisions which may affect generally investment, such as disclosure of information. We really talked about this already, that, you know, the ring fencing will prevent the deduction of expense associated with the newer fields. But one thing I wanted to also point out is we forget about small fields, or we forget about high cost per unit fields. There have been many different presentations to the various bodies of the value of keeping taps open for an extra year, an extra 5 years, or an extra 10 years. When you have high-cost operations, such as, for example, heavy oil, which comes at a much higher per barrel cost than the conventional, or you have a small accumulation, neither one of those probably are able to be, they're not going to be economic if they have to sit there and hold their expenses for 5 to 10 years it takes to develop those assets, then begin recovering them. The ability to deduct those expenses from existing operations could mean that those are brought online, and by bringing those online, they could extend the life of taps and actually bring more barrels out of the legacy fields that you have today. So we just want to say that the negative impact would likely be seen on the higher cost potential oil pools that are up there on the slope.
Next page.
Move on to page 52. Articulate impacts to Middle Earth and Cook Inlet. For those, just a quick explanation, we generally break Alaska up into Cook Inlet, North Slope, and everything in between is Middle Earth. And the only impact that we have to non-North Slope areas is the uncertainty that it creates. And the various things that will come up on interpreting the initiative. What it really will be is it'll be viewed as anything when there's a change. It may have been the North Slope this time, but could it be me next time? And it'll be some thinking, but what impact it would have overall, other than just giving them pause to think about what's going on, we can't articulate.
Thank you. Wrap up questions, comments? Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you agree that the legislature should do everything it can to reduce any uncertainty that may be associated with the Fair Share Act and how it should be applied?
Representative Wilikowski, through the chair, it's up for the legislature to decide what action it wishes to take on the initiative and what it believes is the right thing to do.
Follow up.
Do you think that would, if there are concerns about how this would be interpreted, do you think it would be responsible for the legislature to attempt to clarify those ambiguities?
Senator Wilkowski, the chair, my answer remains the same. It's up for the legislature to decide what it needs and wants to do.
Last question.
But I'm asking you as an expert, you've testified that this creates some uncertainty, and can you say whether or not you believe it would be responsible for the legislature to attempt to clear up that uncertainty in the event the initiative does pass?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, again, I'm going to say I'm not going to determine whether it's responsible or irresponsible to do it or not do it. The legislature will act to get whatever information it needs. I know that the sponsor and the author of this has published many a paper. He is sending emails with all sorts of documents to all the legislatures. So I believe his intent is well known. It then comes down to whether or not there's a need to have him come before a body like this. It's a decision for the legislature to make.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Yes, so just with the a couple comments here. My feeling is that if the initiative sponsor wanted to be clear on his intent, he should have written the initiative to be more clear. But also I want to discuss that in the Fall Revenue Sourcebook, on page 99 and 100, you're looking at allowable lease expenditures, and the CapEx has in fact risen by over $500 million per year for the last couple years and continues to be expected to rise well over $1 billion more than what was happening in, for example, 2016 and 17, when the price of oil was very low. In addition, we have several articles that keep going away on me, as I'm seeing here. This was written in September of 2019, just a few months ago, and it says, clearly, there are many reasons to be optimistic about the future of oil and gas in Alaska. New technologies, new investments, and new players will add more jobs in the industry, more money in the economy and state treasury, and put more oil in the pipeline. Last winter was the North Slope's busiest in 15 years. The trend continues. The point is, SB 21 has had a positive effect. We can see it right here in page 99 and 100, and to imply that it has not, and that we are the lowest in the last 15 years is in fact incorrect. And I just wanted to state that that's not what the facts are showing us. Thank you.
All right, this seeing no further questions, this will conclude today's meeting. And thank you for the presentation, and thanks for the committee participation. We are adjourned at 10:45, excuse me.